I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
It's so hard for me to sit back here in this studio looking at a guy out here hollering my name when last year I spent more money on spilled liquor in bars from one side of this world to the other than you made. You're talking to the Rolex-wearing, diamond ring-wearing, kiss-stealing, wheeling-dealing, limousine-riding, jet-flying son of a gun, and I'm having a hard time holding these alligators down. Woo!
To all hustlers with the same interests, bow your heads as the Lord's mention. Prayer service hell.
It's John Pollock. Joined by Court Bauer, we have returned. Court, we have 2 weeks worth of news to go over and a minor story about the sale of a particular promotion for $4 billion. How are you doing?
Not bad. Not as good as Dana White and the Fertittas, but not bad.
What was MLW, its valuation when you were going to sell it?
Let's just put it this way. There wasn't a bidding war involving William Morris Endeavor. Wish there was, but it'll be interesting to see how this plays out with William Morris Endeavor also representing some of the upper echelon UFC fighters. There's a little bit of a conflict there. It's a massive organization. It has several divisions. So it's not just like one little office and they go down the hallway and say, hey, what are we doing with this contract? But there's definitely some sort of weirdness there for people like Ronda Rousey. So it's a new era.
Chris Weidman's also in there. The way it's been described is that WME, IMG, they were largely representing those fighters when it came to movie roles, kind of different marketing opportunities, and not so much dealing with the UFC and fight management not being their forte. That could very well change. You're right. It presents a kind of weird dynamic because part of this is the idea that you're going to take a lot of these UFC fighters and position them in different roles and get them outside of the UFC exposure-wise. So that could be a big positive for a number of these fighters. But at first reaction, $4 billion. The reports had been out for quite some time. Jeremy Botter had kind of reported that WME IMG was leading a group and $4 billion was the number we had heard. But the fact that this went down and $4 billion was the price attached to this. I mean, does this sound like just a crazy figure to you? Is this something that you feel that years down the road we could look back on and say, you know what, that was about the value here because they saw all these different opportunities where this promotion could still grow globally?
Well, they're selling a lot of it off of the potential of what they could do in markets like Asia, like China, like Europe, where they're just starting to get into and hopefully do more in a lot of those markets, emerging economies like India. And it's also interesting to point out that Wanda, a massive force out in China, had a failed bid to acquire UFC, yet they are putting it out there publicly that they're poised to spend $30 billion this year alone in deals. And it was funny because when this article came out in Variety, they actually labeled the UFC as a wrestling – they had a failed bid for wrestling entertainment empire, UFC. This is according to Variety, that I guess that the UFC is a wrestling empire. It's a distant cousin, but I wouldn't call it a wrestling empire. Maybe, you know, there's aspects of grappling in there, of course. But anyway, Wanda is a major force. And lo and behold, William Morris Endeavor, able to keep a massive conglomerate together to acquire UFC. I mean, it's so hard because you have so many moving parts when you have different partners. And I'm curious to see who's going to be the managing partner of the investment. Because it's usually one sole person is anointed the chairman of this this conglomerate, and they'll oversee the day to day or major decisions for this property. We know Dana White is staying on. Why don't you fill in everyone on the particulars, because those details just have emerged recently.
Yeah. So the way this worked was that Frank and Lorenzo Fertitta each had 40.5% of the company. Dana had about 9%. So Dana had sold his percentage, but then in turn, it was announced he was staying on as president and owner. But they are not disclosing what kind of stake he has. I would imagine it's super minimal. But they signed him to a 5-year deal, and he's entitled to 9% of the company's profits each year. So a really solid deal if you're Dana White. And he was apparently, you know, a big key to this, and him staying on was a big factor, because I think it's a big blow losing Lorenzo Fertitta. I think that kind of more, he's more of a behind the scenes player, but he was a very important part of the UFC's rise. Losing Dana White as well, that's the one that the public, I think, would panic and look at this as being a massive change, which I don't think any kind of ownership group coming in wants to present that perception to the public, that this is something and changing your comfort level in this promotion and how it's run. Dana White is that glue to this deal. So Dana White had stated in the past, if the Fertittas go, I go. He had also stated if this company ever goes public, he would not want to be a part of it. So philosophies have changed, and maybe 9% of company profits, that will change your philosophies. But this could also be something, Court, where a few years down the road, Dana White is quietly moved from a public face to more of a behind-the-scenes player, and then eventually moved on. That's, if you were transitioning, that's kind of what you would do in this case. You wouldn't want to just change this cold turkey and Dana White's gone. That was a big part to this. It's going to be up to Dana White and how much he wants to invest in his life at this point, and whether he's going to stick around for 5 years, 10 years, or midway through this deal, you see kind of Dana White's fingerprints less and less.
Whenever you look at acquiring something this big or anything, I don't care if it's a deli or something, you're looking at what the down the road prospects are. What's your long-term strategy? What's your exit strategy? And it's not something, you know, you necessarily are looking at unless you're like a venture capitalist and you're going to do a quick flip on something. But in this case, I am curious to see what their exit strategy. How many people out there are able to acquire something like this? So say William Morris Endeavor pumps it up to a valuation of $6 billion, something like that, and they want to sell and make a profit of $2 billion. Who are those candidates? And I guess you could still say Wanda could be in there based on spending $30 billion alone this year on different things. But there's not a lot of suitors out there. So that was the first thing when this acquisition went down. I was like, I wonder where they could flip this, because that is the long-term business position I'd like to know. Who are the candidates? We saw very few come to the table. Campbell McLaren with a group bid on I think they landed a $2.8 billion bid, and of course the Fertittas turned that down.
Was he knocking on doors in the neighborhood raising capital? Was Court Bauer asked for a contribution?
Well, let me just say this. I think Dana White being eventually phased out is one scenario. But another scenario would be Dana White, who has a minority interest in the company and is the face of this thing, being in a position where maybe he goes out there and finds the next owners. There's a million ways it could play out 5-10 years from now. We don't know. He could be forced out. He could be. There's so many things that can happen. So we'll see how it plays out. But a new era is on the horizon. It's not here right now, but the next 90 days or less, the transition from Zuffa to William Morris Endeavor will take place.
And also, with Lorenzo Fertitta out as CEO and chairman, those roles are going to have to be filled. And that's going to be the person working most closely with Dana White, who's who's stated the fact that when Lorenzo came on in 2008, it was because Dana, so much was on his plate at that point, and with Lorenzo coming in, it alleviated that. And Dana and Lorenzo, I mean, those guys were best friends. It's very easy to work together when you respect mm-hmm. and you know that person. So that's going to be an interesting role that they fill, whether it's one person, whether it's two people that come in, or multiples to fill what Lorenzo dealt with at that point.
Yeah, and it makes you think, what if one day WWE gets put on the market, and what would its valuation be? Would they be able to get to two? Would they be able to get to $3 billion? I don't know.
Yeah, the WWE aspect is interesting because one of the big things about this whole sale that some people have looked at is the fact that their content is gigantic. I mean, with Fight Pass and all of the libraries right. they have acquired, this is as much a digital content deal as anything. And when you look at other sports where the UFC and the WWE have a leg up on franchises like the Dallas Cowboys, having the rights to, or the NFL even, having the rights to all their games. I mean, there isn't a thriving market of people that want to go back and watch old games, save for, you know, a Super Bowl, perhaps. The WWE, I mean, their library, there is a rabid audience to watch old fights, old matches, and the WWE dwarfs the UFC in terms of the content that they own. And you even saw the WWE get a jump in their stock this week, I'm sure, off of the news here. Not to mention some outlets accidentally reporting that it was the WWE that had purchased the UFC and not WME before those corrections were made.
Yes, it's a big month when you think about everything that's transpiring in July. You had UFC 200. You had this massive blockbuster sale. And then this Tuesday, WWE blows up their entire structure as we know it with the brand split and a new era truly starting for WWE here with the live SmackDown as they go live on Tuesday nights and also the roster split. So I'm curious to see how the draft does in terms of ratings on a Tuesday night and what the complexion of the rosters looks like, because you'll be able to tell who they're tracking to do what and what role based on where they're drafted and when they're drafted. You're not going to see someone, you know, in the 21st guy drafted being probably a player for either roster. But it's going to be interesting to see how they book that show. And just as a whole, this month has just been crazy.
Yeah, this is going to be a huge week for the company. Just news-wise, going into the draft, you've got Monday night, which they ran the risk of that being a lame duck show and turned that around with the GM announcements for Monday night, which has fueled speculation as to who will fill those roles. And then Tuesday night, this is insane, Court. You're going to have 3 hours on Monday night, and then you come back Tuesday night. They're doing pre and post shows and a companion show on the network head-to-head with themselves. Now, I don't know if this is going to be a straight two-hour Draft Center special they have on the network or just coming in and out during commercial breaks, but you were there the first time they tried this with the Unlimited experiment, and the USA Network was like, hey, WWE, what the hell? We are driving people to our commercials, and you're telling them to tune out. Stop this.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it was a lot of work because it's hard just putting a live show together, but when you're putting in those supplemental content in between the breaks, it's first of all, it's like, what is it? A lot of time it becomes throwaway stuff. At first, the strategy was give them something that makes them have to switch over, you know, do a finish on the Unlimited feed or something like that. But it really at the time was taxing the resources that we had. Now it's a different world because they have this big, massive production set up just for WWE Network programming, and it's a much more enormous production facility on the road. So they can probably handle it a little better. What will advertisers say? I don't know. I guess they're saying, listen, they're not flipping the channel. Maybe they're watching it on their tablet. That's going to probably be the strategy so you don't alienate your partners there and say, hey, listen, the TV's on, the commercial's playing in the background, they're just using their tablet or their phone to look at this additional content. They're not going to go through switching over to Rokus or Xboxes or PlayStations to access this. I would imagine that's probably the case. I think it would just be too big of a pain in the ass. So either people are just not going to do it, or they're going to use a tablet or smartphone. But is it worth it in the end? I don't know. It's an experiment. We'll see if it's worth their while.
Now, just looking ahead to Monday night, who would you put in these roles, Court? And is this overload when it comes to the authority figures with, I guess, from the top down, we have Vince McMahon overseeing this thing with the two commissioners who will oversee the two general managers? I can only assume we will have assistants to the general managers as well. So we have a whole series of the WWE's government.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of layers to this at this point. And,
they should have held an election, Court. They should have held an election.
I actually think it would have been cool if they had actually let one of the people be decided by a poll or something, and you give it your three draft picks of who you'd like to see there, you know, Eric Bischoff, Daniel Bryan, or Paul Heyman, whatever it is, and see where it takes you, because that could actually have been a fun way to play with this. But, I guess we'll see what the reveals
are. Is Bryan a lock? Do you feel he's got to be one of them?
I don't know. I kind of like where he's at with the Cruiserweight series that they're doing on the WWE Network, which I really highly recommend everyone check out. It's a real quick, breezy 50 minutes. It's a lot of fun. The bracketology show they did last week was terrific. The first episode was fantastic. I thought Mauro and Daniel Bryan did a great job together, and I think Daniel Bryan's going to get even more comfortable as time goes on. But he called it kind of like a shoot and had like almost an MMA approach to how he called it. Mauro can, you know, given his background in MMA and in boxing, did a great job too. So I really liked the presentation. I can't recall how many times they said pro wrestling or wrestler, not performer, not sports or entertainment. They called it a sport, not the business, not the industry. So there are a lot of cool elements. I like the throwback aesthetic to the graphics packaging with the just 80s kind of vibe to it. I don't know what was going on at the beginning. It looked like I swear to God, it looked like Snake Eyes from G.I. Joe was in the opening to this thing. But that was cool, too. I can't say that's a bad thing. But I really enjoyed just how they did it and how they dressed up Full Sail University. And from
because that was not a full venue. Mm-hmm. And from someone that was there live on Thursday night where they taped the second round matches, it seemed like that was, at least prior to the show, not a giant turnout either. I mean, they did the NXT tapings Wednesday night, asking people to come back the next night as well. That's kind of tough for the same arena. But going back to the commentary, you've produced a lot of these shows where you have to produce the commentary team. What is your philosophy when it comes to how much you're micromanaging the announcers? Does it depend on the personalities, how much you just let them go?
Right.
Because I got that feel that with Mauro and Bryan, they believed these two could have a chemistry together and just let them be, where Daniel Bryan was not overly produced or having a guy in his ear constantly throughout the whole broadcast. They were just let to their own devices to call that show.
Yeah, I think it depends on your crew. I think in this case, because Daniel Bryan's new to it, you'd almost want to have him do like a mock run in studio and kind of see where it's at, just do a tryout and then give him some notes so he can make some adjustments. The beauty of this thing also is you have post-production, so if there's a flub or something you want to correct, it's so easy to give it that polish. So this is the great – this is a great way to introduce Daniel Bryan to this space. And, it's a different thing when you're doing SmackDown and Raw in that capacity, because, you're getting different feedback in your headset. In this case, it's the perfect place and perfect environment to see what Daniel Bryan has. I think when you look at, like Jim Ross and Mauro, there's not much you really want to give them, and they really don't need much. Here's tonight's show. Make sure you hit on these few points. And make sure in the aftermath of that finish, look for what happens and sell it accordingly. That's it. I mean, some guys you really need to hold their hand, and you don't know that until you really work with them a bit and see, you know, some guys are green and just need some fine tuning and they're too aggressive. Like, for example, if you look at Jim Ross and Paul Heyman in WCW around 1990, 91 on the WWE Network, you can see JR is at that point very polished, of course. But Paul E, who was incredibly talented, a lot of energy, was like almost had to figure out how to dial it down a little bit and figure out the tempo and the ebb and flow of announcing, which he would, you know, later. But he was so young, he was in his early 20s at that point, and you see what he matured into. So just trying to figure out case by case what talent has to offer.
let's get back to the draft and looking at Tuesday night. First of all, the way they set this up this past Monday with Stephanie heading Raw and Shane heading up SmackDown. Of course, this draft is largely to build up SmackDown. So you've positioned SmackDown at the moment as this is going to be the hot brand with lots of changes to it and the curiosity factor. At least on Monday night, Raw was very much positioned as it's going to be the same old show run by the heel and very distinct the way they've positioned these two. So I really feel Stephanie needs kind of that comeback promo on Monday night to give out at least give out a reason why you should return and keep watching Raw for 3 hours on Monday night, because I left Monday night thinking, wow, SmackDown is the hot show to watch. And the promo basically said Raw is outdated with antiquated ideas, and it's going to remain that way.
It's so hard to get an idea of what they're going to do until we see what the draft brings us. And then the next week or two, they should have a lot of momentum coming out of the draft. I'm curious to see how they position the draft. Early on, the draft did very well in the ratings. When I was there, it did very well as you get towards 2008, 2009, 2010-ish. In that ballpark, yeah, it started to get long in the tooth. But there were some cool things they did. They did a supplemental draft that you would have to stay tuned. It would play out overnight and into the next few days. And literally, sometimes we were booking that stuff on the fly and would figure out stuff the day after. So it's like,
wait, Court, what are we going to do with Charlie Haas?
Well, there was one of those things. It's like, man, maybe we should rethink this. And then, oh, surprise, he's been traded back, and all those kind of things would happen. And so that's good. It's going to be interesting to see what creative has, because that's something that people keep talking about. But at the end of the day, the WWE is a tale of two cities in a lot of ways. If you look at WWE's network offerings, if you look at the Cruiserweight Classic, if you look at NXT, a lot of people are very positive on that. A lot of people feel that the SmackDown Raw have been, very erratic in terms of booking. If they can stabilize that, given the roster they have that they're amassing still, it's pretty damn impressive. But it'll be interesting to see who they call up. Who do you think gets the call? I think there's going to be at least one or two people that are shockingly not called up. What's your take? What's your predictions? Let's do a little prediction here.
Okay, well, first of all, I think on Monday night, you have to address the NXT situation for the draft. Because from a logic standpoint, it makes no sense why a GM would draft Finn Balor over Shinsuke Nakamura, who just won this big match this week, or Finn Balor being drafted over their champion in Samoa Joe. I almost feel like Monday you have to say, listen, these are the eligible draft picks from NXT. At least give some reason so that you're not being left with these questions about why would you not draft the NXT champion in the storyline world of the WWE.
That's a great question. That's a great question, right?
Like to me, that's just a natural, yeah. And you can address it in such a way. There's also other things I think they have to make clear on Monday, such as how does the New Day work? They're the tag champions. Can they be broken up? The Miz and Maurice.
They've sold that, actually, that every team could be at risk at breaking up. So you really got to hope that you can get the New Day together or some of these acts. It's bizarre and hard, but at the same time, it's like if there's one act I'd like to see split up, would be the Vaudevillains, I think.
Oh, they're dying at this point.
I think they need to be reimagined ASAP, and I don't want to see a Deacon or something like that happen. But at the same time, I think that they might. I can't remember the taller one's name. Aiden
English.
He could be Cesaro's younger brother. I swear to God, I'm not saying they should become brothers all of a sudden, but there are some similarities there. At least
maybe they're going to draft Jack Gallagher from the Cruiserweight Classic, God. And he will, and it will be now. They're just going to create a six-man division with the Wyatts, with the New Day.
I don't mind six-mans. I don't mind the trios thing. I love that, man. But and I know Michael Hayes loves booking six-mans on top, especially for the dark matches. They're a lot of fun, and guys can shine and don't have to kill themselves in that setting. But yeah, there's going to be some weirdness on how they handle these bundled packages. Rusev and Lana is an example.
Yeah, none of that has been addressed, and how you are going to just, like, I don't know. You don't want to break up a number of these different acts, but at the same time, you've kind of hinted at, you know, all these teams could be broken up. They even, like, the first week of the draft announcement, it was the New Day approaching Stephanie and saying, hey, what about us? We're the tag champions. And they never got an answer. So you're kind of left to believe that they're all on their own, regardless of being the tag champions or not. So it's kind of all these weird questions. I do think it's a given that Rollins and Ambrose are likely split, and that goes into the Raw main event on Monday night, and who's going to have the title going into Battleground, and where Reigns ends up as well, who you figure has to be an early pick as well, even though he's not going to be there on Tuesday night. And on top of that, it hasn't even been stated yet if it's going to be a traditional draft where you come out and you make your pick in order like they did the first year in 2002, or if it's just going to be the lottery format and it's just a spin of the wheel and it's going to land on guys as they did afterwards as a way to build the show rather than all your top picks are going at the start of the show.
Yeah, it's a weird one. And I also wonder, where do you think Shaq ends up in the draft?
Dude, this video, this angle they shot on the red carpet with Big Show and Shaq, have you ever seen an angle shot, much forget a WrestleMania, for just any kind of celebrity-involved match that had, pardon the pun, less heat than it began? I mean, these two are just, the end of it, I love you, brother, and they're hugging at the end of this. It's like, listen, what is this?
Listen, it's a very abusive relationship. They hug, then they have some issues, then they hug it out. I mean, I like the idea of Big Show at WrestleMania 33. He had a lot of time playing for the Orlando Magic, along with Penny Hardaway, a great dynamic duo back in the early to mid-90s.
Well, that's great, because this angle, it might draw a Penny based on this angle.
Oh, hey. Big Show and Shaq, to me, is not the right configuration. I think this one's a few years too late. I'd like to see someone else against Shaq. I can't give it to you off the top of my head, but I just feel like this is a little – this is going to diminish, in all due respect to all parties, but this is a diminished attraction at 2016. You can use Shaq in some capacity, but that match – right there as it's configured, I don't think it has a wow factor. I think you can – I mean, I understand the counters. Shaq just wrestling anyone is a big attraction and will cross over and get coverage from ESPN. That's true, but does it pump it up to optimize its potential at the box office? I don't think so.
Well, just give me some tension. Give me some reason to want to see this match. Instead, it was like two best friends who want to go play wrestling for a night in Orlando. Well, that's how it felt watching this red carpet angle.
Maybe there's something to Big Show and Shaq teaming up against someone. I mean, the problem there is they're two baby faces, and how many heels can you feed them that would put them in jeopardy? So that's a problem.
The social outcasts.
Oh God. Well, that's the thing. That's where it goes usually with something like this.
They're going to market it as the biggest kickoff show in history. Well, Shaq and Big Show teaming up.
I'm curious to see if that match ends up happening. You never know. Maybe Ronda Rousey, maybe Paige Van Zandt. Who knows come next year at or in Orlando what will transpire. But I do know one guy that will be in Orlando, and that's Jumpin' Jim Ross. He'll be bringing his one-man show to Orlando. He announced he'll be playing Saturday, April 1st and Sunday, April 2nd, two matinees. So you have time to go over to the Hall of Fame and WrestleMania, and that will be at the Plaza. Tickets go on sale the day after SummerSlam. Go to MLW.com because JR is partnering with Wale Mania 3. We're doing multiple events over the whole weekend. And so Saturday and Sunday are JR's day. We're going to kick off the whole weekend with the Thursday traditional Wale Mania show at Tier Nightclub. And so we're getting bigger and badder with this thing every year. So it's cool to have Jim Ross along for the crazy ride.
On a scale of 1 to 10 audience, how was Court Segway there? That was just fine, the finest of
man.
Plugs inserted.
I was working on that before I had the conversation about Shaq. I'm like,
I can see the script right here.
Yeah, there's
a Shaq literally used the basketball player to pivot.
Whoa, terrible pun. Terrible pun.
Outstanding pun.
Listen, one thing I don't know how to transition to this, but WWE has scrapped the upcoming ECW DVD release. They were going to do something called OMG. ECW's top 50 craziest moments.
I loved when the ECW crowds would chant OMG during a big spot at the ECW arena. That was a famous chant. Nothing I would rather hear than OMG, OMG.
Yeah, I think ECW predates texting and the OMG era. But that's been...
Where are we on the ECW nostalgia trip at this point? Has it worn out its welcome? Because every time you think it has, one of these shows pops up and it still draws and people... I think as a live event outside of WWE, I think people will still flock to see the ECW veterans. But we're at a point now that I think it's kind of exhausted itself.
Yeah, I think it's time to move off of that. You know, but you know, the weird thing is if you were to watch a DVD like that at this point, it's like a lot of the stuff you'd see, those craziest moments. You know, if it's a lot of the stuff that I think of crazy moments, half of them are angles from ECW. The other half are like crazy spots, like New Jack flying off the top of a stage onto Vic Grimes or something, going through those tables, like that crazy, insane shit. But it's like, do you really want to market that? Do you really want to sell this product to the masses and put that out there before the media in 2016? I don't know, but they already had filmed interviews with Taz, Tommy Dreamer, Joel Gertner, and I'm assuming Paul Heyman for this, and I'm sure those will be repurposed in some capacity.
I'm sure you will find a place for them. You know, some of the most interesting stuff with ECW is simply some roundtable discussions with the key players of a lot of these characters and the stories and how they were generated and the thought process behind it, where you don't have to so much necessarily rely on the footage, which in the WWE Network, it's very hard for these ECW shows to replicate that feel that they had originally, because the music is edited and that takes away a lot whenever I've gone back and watched these shows. But you still have all of those minds that are essentially under your umbrella or available, like a Taz, that you could bring in and do a special on them, do a roundtable chat and just focus on one particular angle, focus on the Dreamer Raven story and have them there and sit down and discuss it. I think that there's lots of interest still with ECW that doesn't have to just be rehashing best of DVDs or OMG moments.
Paul Heyman does the best job of all the people they can get to give a real perspective on it. He doesn't do the self-aggrandizing thing. You'll see a lot of the guys there doing, you know, just talking it up and talking in this unrealistic sense of what it was and what was there. He's very honest and blunt about the good and the bad. And I'd love to see guys like Todd Gordon pop up. I'd love to see guys as abrasive as a personality as he is, but God, he was so intertwined with the business end of the operation. Steve Carroll, who's out of New York City, not exactly a photogenic gentleman, but at the same time, intricately involved in all the key deals, the pay-per-view deal, the licensing deals, the video game deals, all the TV rights, everything. He was right there, and he looks like Paul Heyman, but he's like 80. He has like the skullet thing. They look like they're distant cousins or something, but he'd be a great guy to interview for, you know, maybe something for the network. And did you see, speaking of the network, the WWE is surveying fans about new benefits that they're considering offering, including a bundled $99.99 offer for 1 year. So you're paying just under $100, $99.99, or 6 months at $49.99. And it's doing things like the ability to vote for who should be in the Hall of Fame, which is an interesting and provocative thing that –
yeah.
It'd be kind of cool, but also at the same time could be disastrous. You just know with voting, it could get really weird. The ability to watch offline content, that's an interesting feature. An ad-free version of WWE.com, which I don't think people are thinking they need.
The ads are really inintrusive on the network. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about 10 seconds.
No, this would be for WWE.com. This is some sort of
bundled. Oh, for WWE.com. Sorry, I thought you meant the network.
That's weird. No, this is like a bundled thing. Like they're trying to like bundle it with WWE.com, including giving you perks with Hulu Plus and stuff. I mean, just all types of – they're throwing everything out there. Maybe we can, you know, mash this all together in some sort of overall bundle. But they're trying to connect all their content in a way that's going to be hard when you think about Hulu, which is owned by several major masters of the universe in TV and film.
Including NBC.
Yeah, so I don't know how you're going to get so creative with that and bundle it with the network and your web stuff. If it's just the network and the website, that's easier to do but still seems challenging on the back end. But they're looking at ways to freshen this thing up, which they should do because this thing has been around for a few years now, which is crazy to think about. But they need to find ways to keep people coming back, add value, and keep this thing rolling. You know, keep trying to get that number higher and higher. But if you talk to people in the company, they are thrilled with how the network is performing.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be something that they'll have to address with the addition of all these pay-per-view shows that they're adding with the brand split. Is this the time you do the price increase? Because I think if they don't do it now, they're probably never going to be increasing the price, at least not for the foreseeable future. You have a built-in reason to say, hey, we're adding all of these shows and we're going to move it up to $11.99, for instance, per month, which it's a small increase that I don't think would turn off too many people. There's a reason for it. And that's a big change in their revenue. If you can add $2 a month, multiply that by all of the subscribers, I would risk it myself increasing it.
Yeah, it's something that makes sense, I think, to try. And you know, I don't know what the value is of no ads on WWE.com, but yeah, you know, maybe there's a big demand. They've got a lot of feedback that they hate seeing those banners or whatever. I don't know.
You mentioned Steve Carroll, and it reminded me of this email I got this week where the subject was groundbreaking street crime wrestling drama. Urban Wrestling Federation returns to pay-per-view this month with Hood Killa.
Oh.
And here's a quick description. The drama in the Urban Wrestling Federation finds hip-hop rapper street bosses pitting their goons and thugs against each other in an attempt to not only one-up one another for that championship belt bragging rights, but to get that good old-fashioned paper, cash money. When Steve the Hustler Carroll proposes putting fights between these bosses' goons on television and letting them expand their questionably legal street enterprises, he has many takers. Hip-hop bosses such as New York's own The Prince of New York, DJ Self, Uncle Murda, Cuban Link, Torch, and Red Cafe, as well as Miami's Billy Blue, Briscoe, Gunplay, and Young Breed, to Atlanta's Russell Big Block Spencer, and Chicago's LEP Bogus Boys. They have all stepped up for the challenge to reign as the ultimate street king in the Urban Wrestling Federation. So that is on pay-per-view this month. That was just a free plug that we are going to give them, but how can you not be enticed to spend a few dollars on pay-per-view for Hood Killa?
Well, nothing says stereotyping like that. I mean, that's crazy. I don't know what else to say, but hey, if that's your thing, I have at it. I don't know how successful
I almost
it
guarantee
is.
Me and Way will review this.
Well, then they'll have one purchase.
Whoa. We are almost 40 minutes into this show, and we have yet to utter the name Brock Lesnar. So let us discuss what occurred on Saturday night. His performance, first of all, I assume you watched UFC 200?
Oh, God, yes. And I watched it, and I was
And you did a post-show.
I did
so
a post-show.
So that's how out of
yes.
the loop I was.
Now, your head was spinning out in Vegas, and it had nothing to do with all the liquor you were taking. It was just all the news breaking and all the fights. I mean, I don't know how you're even with it almost 7 days later. But it was, you know, that was a big badass battle, and every Brock Lesnar fight's an unpredictable fight, and I never thought this thing would go three rounds. Mark Hunt just – looked like he was on life support, just didn't seem to have any vitality in his fighting at all. There was nothing there. Just, I mean, when Brock Lesnar's leg checking you, that's puzzling. Brock owned him. It was like watching a sixth grader take on a third grader on the schoolyard. And yes, the second round was a little different, a little awkward, but Mark Hunt didn't show me much, and I'm a huge fan of Mark Hunt, so I really was conflicted on who to root for this one. But at the same time, I thought Mark did not bring it just for his own self. I thought he'd do a lot more.
I think he really respected Lesnar's power in the first round, maybe too much, because that first round was when Lesnar, I think, was still trying to figure out Mark Hunt's timing, Mark Hunt's striking, and he was easily able to telegraph that overhand right and was able to just take him down repeatedly. And Mark Hunt had a hell of a time trying to get back up once Lesnar got those takedowns. And Lesnar did get hit in the first, definitely won the first. I thought Hunt won the second, and then it was a 10-8 third round for Lesnar. I mean, he did what he needed to do to win, and I mean, it wasn't a fight of the year candidate or anything like that. And now the interesting question is what you do next with Brock Lesnar, because I certainly get the sense he wants to fight again. I'm sure the UFC wants him to fight again. I don't think there's any bigger heavyweight fight you could make than Lesnar challenging for the heavyweight title. And I could totally see Lesnar leapfrogging everyone if he were allowed to fight again. It comes down to WWE and how they view that, how this one went, and is there more for us to gain versus what we've already received out of this deal with the UFC? Is it worth rolling the dice yet again with Brock Lesnar when he's going to be in there with a really dangerous guy, whether it's a Dos Santos or a Cain Velasquez or even the winner of Stipe Miocic and Alistair Overeem? Because those are the options you're looking at. It's not going to be him fighting anyone lower than Mark Hunt, who is a dangerous striker in his own right.
I'm most compelled by the Overeem option because it's the
That's the biggest one. If he,
the score.
Especially if he wins the title, and that's the rematch. Lesnar trying to avenge that loss. They have the backstory, and it's Lesnar going for that title. That's a huge fight. Huge fight.
Yeah, it is. And the Overeem of today is much different. And it, in my opinion, it has nothing to do with the fact that the dude is a few years older. I would love to see that fight. And I'd like to see it in its most honest version. And I think we could see that. I think Arlovsky is another option, but to me the sexiest, most compelling one is a rematch with Overeem, because I think it's a different fight, and I think Brock would want that fight. I think Brock would be wanting to settle that score, and this would be an interesting opportunity to do it. But we'll see if he does that second fight. I think he will, but will it be this year or next year? And here's the thing. You're looking at the schedule. If it's next year, you think it's either got to be in January to me. I guess you could do it in February too, but really it can't be after February. And then you got pause for March and into April, and then he's got to do a fight camp. So you're looking at maybe next July. So to me, he is up until February to do a fight. And then the next time you can see him is in July. So I'm thinking maybe he'll fight by, in December. Who knows? Or maybe he'll never fight again. Again, it's just hard to know at this point.
How about the other big WWE talent that had a notable mainstream exposure over the past couple of nights? That was John Cena at the ESPY mm-hmm. Awards. Did you happen to see any of his hosting? I got to see the first 20 minutes of the show, and I thought his monologue was great. I thought this guy came off tremendously well.
He's really setting himself up for a post-40 run here, and he deserves it. He has so many different TV projects in the pipeline. He's signed on for a new reality pack. So, yeah, I thought he did a great job. And much like The Rock on SNL, this to me was a showcase opportunity for John Cena to show a different audience, the media, a lot of influencers out in LA, a lot of people in TV and film that are in that crowd, who this guy is and what he's about and what he can do. Because hosting a show, yes, this is not exactly the Oscars. It's a little bit more lax, and the pressure isn't the same. But he was incredible. And for Vince McMahon and WWE, a wonderful representative of the company. And so, yeah, I thought he did a fantastic job. Ric Flair was there along with Charlotte. I understand Vince and Stephanie were there as well. And so you had a nice turnout from the WWE scene. And you look at that ESPN WWE crossover, it's still crazy to me to see how this thing has matured into John Cena hosting the ESPYs, which will be a great career move for him as he continues to do more things out in Hollywood and in TV. So that to me was a great one. Another thing I want to bring up, just talking a little bit about MMA, Dan Severn's book just came out. Jim Cornette does the foreword for the book, and he's one of the pioneers when it comes to UFC. So I definitely, if you're looking for some good summer reading, check that one out. Actually,
I think Enzo's going to be plugging it every week on television.
And I should also mention that it got the MLW's Editor's Choice Award, the first time we've ever honored a book with that. But
what?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I like.
How do you qualify for that?
It's a new thing we're doing. Like, if we like books and wrestling and MMA, we're just gonna, we're gonna give it some love. It's funny because Jim Cornette, Dan Severn was the first guy I ever interviewed when I was in high school, 1996. Somehow I found his email. It was like the infancy of email for me. And I was like, hey, I want to interview for my newsletter. My newsletter hadn't started, and this was just gonna, I was like, hey, I have a newsletter. Let me try to interview someone. And he was the most accessible guy. And I remember interviewing him on Christmas Eve, 1996. I think, this is so weird. I mean, I'm just a kid in high school. I'm not doing anything Christmas Eve. I was like, this guy's a UFC badass fighter, does stuff with WWF. Why does he have time for me? But he was super cool, very laid back guy, always a pro, great representative of, amateur wrestling, MMA, and pro wrestling as the NWA champion. So check out his book. It's a cool read.
Yeah, and it's called The Realest Guy in the Room for those looking for the Enzo connection. You know, it reminds me of one time, I might have told this story before, I cannot remember, but when myself and Mauro Ranallo, the voice of SmackDown, we were doing a show called Fight Network Radio, and we had Dan Severn on one day. And at this point, this was early in the show's history, where we tried to get three guests on in the hour. And our second guest went long, so the final guest was Dan Severn. And literally, we play like an intro for him, and we've got 2 minutes before the show is over. So Mauro literally brings on Dan Severn, asks him a question, and then, thanks a lot, Dan. It was a pleasure to have you on. And then Dan calls me up afterwards. It's just like, hey, man, I would be more than happy to come back and do an actual interview. I don't know what happened there. And I had to explain, I'm really sorry. We were against the clock and had to be out. We would love to reschedule you. But yeah, we brought Dan on for a question in probably 2007 at some point. So his book probably does much more justice to his career than our interview
did. Well, he did bury you guys. I want to put that out there. He thought it was the most unprofessional experience. No. But it's a cool book. And I mean, look, those guys, you look at this guy who would one day wrestle, you know, in, you know, a pro wrestling show somewhere, and say in, you know, Georgia or something, and then the next week be on a UFC card or something. This guy was just, he really, I mean, right into his 50s was fighting in MMA, which, you know, at any age is a very tough thing to do. But he kept going and going. I mean, it's amazing. Look at his body of work. Unbelievable. And just an amazing amateur wrestler.
Before we wrap up the show, mm-hmm. let's talk a little bit about TNA. Moose made his debut on television this past Tuesday night. The rating was down from the week prior, which was their record they set on Pop with 410,000 viewers. They were down, I believe it was about 358 this week. Mm-hmm. They're moving to Thursday nights next week. There was a big push for it on the show on Tuesday. Where does TNA fit in this point? Because I feel this is the most buzz this company has had in a long time because of the broken Matt Hardy, Brother Nero storyline that has – it's clicked with people. I never would have imagined that it would, but it has. And I've enjoyed these two.
Yeah, I think – look, some people are going to criticize it. Some people are going to say it was awesome. The bottom line is people are talking about it, and I think it did wonders for TNA just to set them apart from everything else. And you know, the biggest form of flattery is when someone tries to replicate what you did. And it's been done since they did that deal by WWE. And
this is the best online feud as well. Broken Matt Hardy and Bray Wyatt. I mean, this is just so entertaining.
I think Matt's done a really good job. I haven't really seen much of Bray's tweets, but I've seen Matt's response to some of the stuff, and he's handled it, I thought, very well. I don't know if maybe Bray's done the same. I just haven't seen them. But I look, you can't do this every week. You shouldn't do this every month. You shouldn't do this really probably even every year. But it's just something different, just like the empty arena match. People still talking about it because it was different. But if you actually watch the empty arena match between Jerry Lawler and Terry Funk, it's different, but it's not exactly what I call a piece of art when it comes to pro wrestling, but it's one of those watershed moments that people talk about 30 years later. Will people be talking about Final Deletion 30 years? Who knows? But it was different and outrageous and took a lot of imagination. And as long as they don't make this a weekly thing, I think it's fine. And now TNA hopefully continues to let them do more. I understand Jeremy Borash had a lot to do with the creative end with it. And so maybe you start to lean on him to do more of these things than those that you have in the past, because he's kind of the utility player for TNA. He's done just virtually everything, promoting, ring announcing, just anything and everything they've needed of him. He has that can-do attitude and has been with the company through all the regimes, which says a lot to be able to survive anywhere.
This is the guy that should be going into the TNA Hall of Fame.
Jesus, really? I mean, no joke.
Like, honestly, like, hey, Gail Kim, sure. important figure in TNA history. Jeremy Borash, when the book is written on TNA, I mean, that guy has done every single job. And I don't think he gets anywhere near the credit that he should for everything he's been placed into, from just the way he is like the MC at these house shows and did great in that role. Commentary, creative. I mean, everything that this guy is placed in, I think he's one of the more undervalued guys that not just TNA has. I think in any company that he could be utilized for. I didn't even know that he was directly involved with all the final deletion stuff. But, I mean, it takes some wild stuff to come up with what they did. And for it to click in the way it did, I think you can't do that every week, those kinds of segments. But you've got a character in Matt Hardy. This character is over. I mean, I don't think there's any disputing that. You can hate this character or not, but there is interest in this guy. And I think it's only Jeff Hardy could be in that role as the foil to broken Matt Hardy. And these two, let's be honest, TNA got out of this Hardy's feud, which the WWE never could.
No. And it's hard because I think they knew going in that brother versus brother, just like even Gibson versus Morton and Steiner versus Steiner, when you have these lovable tag team acts, when you try to face them off against each other, I remember I've seen every version, you split them up and it's just like, it just never feels right to see them go at it. You think there's just going to be this big box office appeal, but very rarely has it worked. Owen Hart versus Brett was a lot of fun. It didn't blow up the box office though. But it was a lot of fun to watch. I thought Owen did a great job. I thought Brett did a great job. I thought WWF did a great job at the time. But it didn't go in. It didn't take WWF into a different direction. It didn't pop ratings to a different level. But at the same time, it was one of the better versions of brother versus brother that I've seen in pro wrestling. So it's very hard to do. And I thought Matt, he really went off the deep end. And that takes a lot that to be that fearless, get outside your comfort zone. Because at that point, when you're at his point in his career, it's like you have your spots, the crowd's conditioned to them. They're conditioned to how you look and everything you do and how you're presented. To flip the switch and go in a different direction and reinvent yourself, that's a wild, outrageous thought. Yet he did it, and he did a fantastic job.
Last thing. Coming up over the next week, we've got 3-Hour Raw, a SmackDown Live show with 10 million hours of accompanying programming on Tuesday night. The J-Cup starts. We have the conclusion of Ultima Lucha Dos. We've got the Cruiserweight Classic. The G1 is starting. Mm-hmm. NXT continues.
Yes. Yes.
What is Court Bauer going to be watching next week? What is your priority programming?
Oh, a little of this, a little of that. There's a lot, though. And, of course, the draft. Of course, the Cruiserweight Classic. I'm going to get to G1. I'm going to follow your lead on what to watch and what to avoid because there's just so much to go through in that thing. So it's a real pick 'em this summer. It's a great summer to be a pro wrestling fan. And also, in August, on August 13th, WXW out in Germany has announced that they are going to start their own streaming network. We see them continually popping up here and there, but it's called WXW Now. And on the 13th of August, they're going to roll it out. It costs $9.99 a month, and you get it at WXWnow.de. And it'll show virtually the entire library from 2006 to the present, $9.99 in euro. You can use PayPal and credit card, but that's another option. Now you can get all that great stuff from Germany. You can see early Cesaro. You can see Chris Hero, a lot of familiar names from here in the States, a lot of great talent from out in Europe. So really between New Japan World, between WWE Network, at WXW Now, there's so much content you can get over the top through these streaming platforms and, you know, all this stuff that's available through like Progress Wrestling. It's a great time to be a wrestling fan. So there's a shit ton to get on, not just stuff you mentioned, but just a sea of great wrestling out there. So it's a great time to be a wrestling fan and check it out. I should really get paid for these goddamn plugs. Jesus Christ.
What is coming up in the world of MLW this weekend and beyond?
Well, this Sunday, Freddie Prinze Jr. Stops by the VIP lounge to talk about his time as a member of the WWE creative team. I think this is his first podcast talking about the experience. So Freddie Prinze Jr. will be joining MVP to talk about that along with Alex Greenfield. And we'll have a special post-WWE draft edition of MLW Radio. We'll drop a little bit later than our usual evening, early evening time slot on Tuesday nights to review the madness that ensues on that show. And then we have History in the Making coming back this coming week. week where Matt Farmer, our resident historian, talks about the Great American Bash. And that's a real fun show. If you want to learn about the early years, how it came together conceptually, the business end, the feuds, all that fun stuff, History in the Making drops this coming Thursday. It's a VIP exclusive show, so don't miss out on that. And then the Tiki Bar with Tama Tonga and Friends returns tomorrow. So that's a free podcast. And we're also now available on iTunes with our own feed. You can get it on RSS. Subscribe for free. Just go put in Bauer and Pollock. We have a nifty little graphic there. And if you just want our show and only our show, you can get it now that way. And that's all the plugs I have, my man.
Over here, you can go to liveaudiowrestling.com. We have all of our regular shows. And coming up this weekend, we have Jake the Snake Roberts on The Law, Sunday night at 11 Eastern. We'll have a review of Raw Monday night with myself and Wei Ting, and a review of SmackDown Live late Tuesday. So forget the WWE going head-to-head with itself. It looks like myself and Cork going head-to-head as well on Tuesday. So you can listen to both our reviews and compare. And final thing, I do want to mention, if you are a wrestling fan that does not have the Fight Network, I just want to give you a list of the promotions we now have airing on the Fight Network. In addition to ROH and Impact, we've also added the New Japan show, which airs on Access in the U.S. We also have CMLL, Insane Championship Wrestling, British Weekly Wrestling, AAA, Wrestle Center Voltage out of Halifax, Nova Scotia, and Paragon Pro Wrestling. So you can check your local listings of Fight Network and get a whole lot of professional wrestling.
Get it on Roku. Get it on the Roku. We have it here in the States on the Roku. It's great. It's super convenient. You can watch so much on that. You have on demand. It's great.
Last night I turned it on, and there in HD was Tanahashi and Okada from April of 2013. Just nuts. So there you go. That is all the plugs that any listener can take. So that's going to wind things down. A note on this show. We will be back in 2 weeks. We are going to be doing this show bi-weekly, and it is largely because of me. Court is very upset, but I
am burning up right now. Just burning up.
Yes. I cannot even listen to my voice as much as I'm sure many of you out there cannot. And we're going to try and do this show bi-weekly. It's just a very difficult schedule on my end to be doing this every single week. So we are going to be doing every other week, same time on Fridays, until Court just loses it on me and gives me the final deletion.
Oh, my God. Wow. I just thought of a concept for Orlando.
Oh, Court's going to send a drone on me. So we will be back on are we going to be back in 2 weeks, July the 29th? Does that work for you, Court?
Well, you just announced it. I don't have much of a fucking choice.
All right. Well, there you go. Now you are done this show, and you can delete us.